I want to start by asking just a couple of questions. Let me ask you this, and I'm curious. Well, I'm not going to read your mind, but let me just ask you this. What's the greatest invitation you've ever been given? Perhaps maybe your mind is going to a wedding, and maybe someone's invited to a wedding, or maybe you're invited to some special celebration, a retirement party. Or what about this? What's the greatest challenge you've ever been given? Maybe it's a challenge you've given yourself. Maybe it was a challenge to finish school or start your own business. Maybe it was someone else who gave you a challenge. What's the greatest request that was ever made of you, or the greatest command, perhaps, that was ever made of you? Whatever it is, we're going to talk about the greatest invitation, the greatest challenge, the greatest command that's ever been given to any one of us, and that's Jesus' command to follow me, not Pastor Ryan, but follow Jesus. Jesus calls all of us to follow him. Last week, we talked about who is worth following, and we joked about how, it's not really a joke, it's just reality. We talked about how Obama is number one on Twitter, apparently, according to Google, of most followers. I think he was up to 111 million, and Justin Bieber was third at 108 million. And we asked the question, who's worth following in this world? And Jesus, in this passage today, he's going a step further. We're not just talking about who's worth following. We're actually looking at Jesus saying, "Follow me. I'm worth it." The Gospel of John is pointing to the fact that Jesus is worth it. He's worth following. And when we talk about following God, we're not talking about simply liking someone on Facebook or just following someone on Twitter and just, you know, just appreciating or being aware of what they're saying. When I say follow Jesus today, we're talking about giving God your 100% total commitment. You're giving him your mind, your heart, your soul, your spirit, your dreams, your goals, your ambition, your everything. And that's what Jesus is asking for when he says, "Follow me." Last week, we were continuing on in the series in John, and last week, John talked about two important people. One of them was John the Baptist, who was considered by Jesus to be the greatest prophet who had ever lived, and he felt unworthy to be even Jesus' slave, and his job was simply point people to Jesus. And John has also reminded us or told us that Jesus was God, that he existed eternally with God, that creation came to be through Jesus. Jesus created everything that was, and John also said that this Jesus became a human and lived among us. He dwelt among us. He made his home among us. And so that's where we're going to pick up today. We're going to pick up today in John chapter 1, verse 35. And what we're going to talk about today, we're going to look at Jesus' invitation to many disciples that he interacted with when he invited them to follow him. Now, in this passage, as we close off the first chapter, Jesus is going to interact with I'm identifying four different types of disciples or people who are going to decide to follow him. And what I find fascinating is that he approaches each and every disciple in a very different way. And you're going to discover that the end goal is the same, is there's an invitation to follow, but the way he approaches everyone is different. And as you read through these different disciples and these different interactions, I want you to just kind of keep in the back of your mind, which disciple do you most identify with? Or which type of person do you most identify with? And so we're going to start at verse 35 today of John chapter 1. Which starts like this. John 1:35 says this: "The next day John," as in John the Baptist, "was there again with two of his disciples. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, 'Look, the Lamb of God.'" In other words, that's the Messiah. That's the one that we've been waiting for. That's the one whom God has promised. "When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, 'What do you want?' They said, 'Rabbi,'" which means teacher, "'where are you staying?' 'Come,' he replied, 'and you'll see.' So they went and saw where he was staying, and they spent that day with him. It was about 4 p.m. And so the first disciple is actually a couple of disciples. The first category we're looking at is the disciples of John, which I'm calling true searchers of truth. Disciples of John, true searchers of truth. And what I find fascinating about this interaction is that Jesus, he's not approaching these guys. He's not talking to them. He's just walking by. He's not even acknowledging them, at least at the start here. And John the Baptist just simply points to him, and these disciples take off and leave. And this is what's interesting to me. In that culture, in that time, a disciple was someone who was seen to be loyal to their master, to whoever it was that was discipling them. I know in Jesus' ministry, he had disciples that walked with him for years, multiple years, and they got to the point where they were willing to die for him. They were willing to put up a fight for him when he was about to be arrested. And so it's very possible that these disciples of John the Baptist were disciples of the greatest prophet who had ever lived. They were possibly with him for years. And at the drop of a hat, Jesus walks by, John points to them, and these disciples they're gone. They're following Jesus. These guys were loyal to the truth. They were true searchers of truth. And the thing is, these true searchers of truth, they were loyal to the truth wherever it pointed, wherever it leaded, and wherever it led them. Do you identify with this kind of a person? Are you the kind of person who searches the truth and pursues it wherever it leads? Regardless of your background, whatever your assumptions are, regardless of whatever you've been told, are you truly searching for the truth? The Gospel of John says, the Bible says, and particularly the Gospel of John says, basically, that a true searcher of truth, if you're truly searching for truth, you're going to see Jesus as the completion of that search. Later on in the Gospel of John, we'll see that John says that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. He's actually just quoting Jesus. He's saying, if you're truly searching for truth, at the end of that road, you should and will find Jesus. But the tragedy is that sometimes we prefer to stay in the truth rather than looking and finding the person we're actually looking for. If I could just give you an illustration here. Some time ago, I was playing hide and seek with my children. I like playing games from time to time with my kids, and I can't quite remember all the scenarios and all the rules to this particular game, but I was hiding in the downstairs bathroom in a place that wasn't too difficult to find. We don't have a lot of good hiding spots in our house, unless I guess I want to go in the crawl space. They're never going to, you know, follow me down there. But anyways, I was in the bathroom hiding in a it wasn't a difficult spot to be found. Anyways, my second oldest daughter, she comes into the bathroom, and I know she found me. I know she found me, but she pretended like she didn't. And she walked out of the bathroom, and she pretended with the other kids we were playing with that I didn't find Daddy. We got to keep looking for him. And you know what? She seemed to enjoy searching rather than actually finding the one she was supposed to find. And I think in the same way, we do that the exact same thing in the spiritual realm, some of us. We pretend like we're searching. We pretend like we're really searching for truth, when in the end we're really not, and we're just playing around. We're playing games. And so let me ask you: Are you sincerely, genuinely searching for truth? Because if you are, at the end of that search, you're going to find Jesus. Jesus is the answer for the one who legitimately searches for truth. And so these disciples of John, they were true searchers of the truth, and they were willing to follow it wherever it led. In this case, it led them to Jesus, even to the point where they left their master, the greatest prophet who had ever lived. Is that you? Let's move on to the next disciple, starting off at verse 40. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said and who had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We found the Messiah, that is Christ." And he brought him to Jesus. And so here comes the next guy. But before I do that, I just want to mention here that it's so interesting that Andrew, once he found Jesus, his immediate reaction was to go and tell someone else. But we'll talk more about that later. Anyways, now we get to the second disciple here. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You'll be called Cephas," which when translated is Peter. That's all the interaction we get with this man named Peter in this passage. Peter, I guess John didn't feel the need to record any response of Peter. It's just Jesus showed up. He says, "I know who you are. I know who your dad is, and you're coming with me." Peter is found by Jesus when Peter wasn't even looking for him. Do you identify with that kind of a person, where God found you when you weren't even looking for him? Peter knows his name, he knows his father, he knows his identity, and he gives him a new identity, he gives him a new name, he gives him a new purpose. Peter He, if you don't know, he eventually becomes the leader of the early church. But he wasn't perfect. He was a mess up along the way. He denied Jesus along the way. But yet Jesus just seems to just kind of reach in and handpick him. And in this case, this appears, this interaction with Jesus and Peter. He's not coming to Peter and he's not asking him to follow him. He's saying, I know who you are and you're coming with me. I'm telling you, you've got a new identity, a new purpose, and you're coming with me. But it's cool. Peter's the kind of guy who finds Jesus without even looking for him. And, you know, God does this throughout in our day, in our world today, and he's done that throughout history. Another story in the Bible where this has happened was there was a guy named Saul, and if you're not familiar with Saul, he was a leader at the time of the Jews, one of the religious leaders. He was passionate about Judaism, he was so passionate to the point where he was willing to go hunt down Christians, those who put their faith in Jesus. He hunted them down, he persecuted them, and he even killed some of them and put them in prison. And he was so passionate about this that one day he was on another trip to go hunt down some Christians, and God appears to him in a miraculous vision, and he stops him in his tracks. And through that miraculous experience, Saul then puts his faith in Jesus. And he goes from one of the greatest persecutors of the faith to one of the greatest speakers and examples and leaders of the faith. And he goes on to write a huge chunk of the New Testament. So he goes from persecutor to believer in one shot. Why? Because he found Jesus without even sincerely looking for him. He's kind of like another Peter. This kind of thing is happening in our world today, too. I don't know about you, but oftentimes I hear of stories of Jesus appearing to people in dreams around the world. And sometimes I hear of that happening in the Muslim world where there are no missionaries and all of a sudden Jesus shows up to a Muslim in a dream and all of a sudden they put their faith in Jesus and Jesus finds them without even looking for them. I've also heard of stories of, and maybe you have too, of stories of maybe when people were in their teens or young adult years, I hear of guys maybe being asked to church by a cute girl. And because this girl's a cute girl, she's inviting me to church, maybe I should go to church. And they're not even really interested in church in the first place. Well, they go to church because they just want to have a relationship with this person, and they discover Jesus without even looking for him. That's one of the ways that God reaches people. He finds people without even looking for people. Can you identify with Peter? And when Jesus finds you, he gives you a new identity, he gives you a new purpose. And he changes everything. I think the reality is, I think we should all be able to identify with this one, because I'm not sure if we can ever find Jesus on our own in the first place. Let's move on to the third disciple. See if you can identify with this guy. Verse 43, just one verse. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me. Follow me." And Philip is the disciple who is commanded to follow. Now, when I first read this, I thought, okay, maybe Jesus is politely asking Philip to follow him. I don't think Jesus is politely asking. I think Jesus is commanding. He is commanding. He is creating this incredible invitation, this incredible challenge to Philip, and he's saying, "Follow me." You know, this might not be the best example, but it might be similar to this, but in a much lower level. This past Christmas, we ate a lot of food, and it was wonderful. My wife did a lot of cooking, and she just did a fantastic job. But it got to the point one day where we had ate so much food that my wife just told everyone, "Listen, we need to go on a family walk, and you're coming with me." In a scenario like that, do I really have a choice? You know, is that a request? Is that an invitation, or is that a command? I think it's a command. Yeah. In a similar way too, I was blessed to have my mom down, my grandma down. There's one particular day I came home, my jacket was on, my shoes were on, I had the keys to the car, I had nowhere to go, nothing to do, no agenda. My mom looks at me and says, "Ryan, you're taking me to the store and we're gonna buy some treats. Do I really have an option?" No. I need to go with my mom. Now, let me just share the exact same scenarios with one small detail that's changed. What if I had someone, a stranger who I'd never met before, knocked on my door and requested the exact same thing? So let's say I get a knock on the door, I open the door, and a stranger whom I never met says, "Hey, Ryan, we're going on a walk, and you're coming with me." How do you think I'm going to respond to that? Or someone says, "Hey, Ryan, we're going to go to the corner store and buy some treats. Are you coming with me?" And they're a stranger. I've never met them before. And here's why I say this. When Jesus says to follow me, when he's commanding it, he's not some stranger that means harm for you. He loves you. He knows you intimately. He knows you well. He knows every detail about your life. He knows more details about you than you could ever know about yourself. He loves you. He wants the best for you. And when he says, follow me, it is a command, but it's a command for your benefit. It comes out of a place of love. And maybe there's someone here who identifies with Philip, and in a similar way that deep down inside, that Jesus has been inviting you, he's commanding you to follow him today. And maybe you sense that God is looking into your heart today and commanding you to follow me. And if you're sensing that, I would challenge you to take him up on that offer, because he loves you and wants the best for you. And I want to just highlight again, this is a command of the Lord. This is the greatest command that could ever be given to us. And it's from Jesus today to say, follow me. Now, some might be saying, well, Pastor Ryan, that's not right, because the Bible says that the greatest command is to love God and to love people. Well, here's the deal. You can't properly love God unless you first are willing to follow him and obey him. The scripture is filled from cover to cover, which basically says if you want to love God, you have to obey him, you have to honor him. And if you want to honor him and obey him, it starts with a heart that wants to follow him. And so loving God 101, step number one of loving God is being willing to follow him and obey him. And again, Jesus is saying, I'm better than anyone or anything else you will ever follow, and you need to follow me for your own good because I love you. He's not a stranger at the door saying, let's go on a walk. He's saying, I am a loving father who loves you dearly and wants the best for you. Will you obey his command today? Let's move on to the fourth disciple. Starting at verse 44, Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth, can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. I love this interaction too. And so Nathanael is the fourth disciple we're talking about today. And I'm referring to Nathanael today as the pessimistic skeptic. He's the pessimistic skeptic. He's the guy that questions everything and looks at the glass half full. A couple things that are going on with Nathanael here, and there's two things. First of all, why is he so skeptical? Well, perhaps in his day, there are people that came before him that maybe claimed that they found the Messiah. They found the guy, and in particular in his day, people thought that John the Baptist was the Messiah, but he denied it, so he's thinking if John the Baptist denied it, and if I've never heard about Jesus, surely he can't be the Messiah. Secondly, Nazareth was not a theologically noteworthy place. It didn't mean anything to at least Nathanael. And so Nathanael's thinking, okay, I've never heard about Jesus. And if he truly is the Messiah, he's certainly not going to come from Nazareth. And so he's just in his pessimistic, skeptical mindset, and he can't be convinced otherwise. Do you connect with this kind of a person? Are you a pessimistic skeptic? And by the way, there are pessimistic skeptics both inside and outside the church. It doesn't matter. You can find these kind of people everywhere. But I love Philip's reaction. I love his response. Notice how Philip does not start a theological argument with Nathanael or a philosophical argument with Nathanael. But he just says, hey, come and see. Come and see him for yourself. And now let's see how Jesus interacts with Nathanael. And so we pick up at verse 47. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Then Nathanael declared, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." How in the world did we just go from pessimistic skeptic to full-on believer, full-on follower? Why? there was something that Jesus said with this simple interaction with Nathanael that tipped him off to realize that, man, this man, this Jesus has some supernatural knowledge, and he's got to be the Messiah. I don't know exactly what it was. Maybe it was simply that Nathanael was literally sitting under a fig tree, and no one else would have known unless someone gave him that supernatural knowledge. Maybe Nathanael had some experience with the Lord, some spiritual experience with the Lord under a fig tree that only God would know. And Jesus, by saying that, tipped him off to realize that, man, Jesus had some supernatural knowledge and he must be from God. Whatever it was, it blew him away to the point where he realized, I got to follow Jesus. There's something special about him. Is there someone here who might identify as a pessimistic skeptic? And maybe you're not too sure what to think about Jesus. And by the way, again, we all have doubts. Even those who grew up in the church can have doubts. You're not too sure what to think about Jesus. And for that matter, you're not too sure what to think of those who vouch for them. And maybe you think everyone's just a bunch of hypocrites. And maybe you consider yourself to be an intelligent person. But here's what I would say to you today. Ironically, intelligent arguments are not going to be good enough for you. What you need is not another theological or philosophical argument. What you need is you need to experience Jesus. You need to come and see and experience him for yourself. I'm going to share this story. I shared it before, so I'll be very brief. When I was back in high school, I interacted with a very pessimistic skeptic. It was wonderful. When we had breaks in between classes or lunchtime, we would connect. We would talk about religion and spirituality. He was a very intelligent person. And man, he had a counter argument for everything I said. And he had all sorts of facts and figures that I'd never heard before. And we argued for many days, if not weeks. And it was kind of fun. But eventually I gave up because there was no convincing him anymore. And so eventually what I did, we had this nice relationship, and I said, hey, why don't you come to a Bible study that I'm running at my house. There's a bunch of teens that are coming to my house, and you're welcome to come. And so he, to my surprise, a few weeks later, after I invited him, he came to my house. We had this Bible study. I don't know. I have no idea what we studied. We sang some songs. I have no idea what songs we sang. And at the end, I said, okay, let's go around the circle, and why don't we share some things that we can pray about for each other. So we all shared a few things, and then he just randomly spoke up. I didn't ask him to speak up, but he spoke up and said, listen, I don't know what you guys have, but I want it. And that it that he was referring to was Jesus. He had experienced the genuine presence of Jesus, and it changed the pessimistic skeptic. And so if you identify with Nathanael being a pessimistic skeptic, what you need is not another fancy argument. What you need is to experience Jesus today. There's nothing else that will change you. There's nothing else that will convince you. And so I want to invite you to come and see. Come and see. Come and experience Jesus for yourself. Well, you might be saying, well, where do I start? Well, I think where you start is just having a real, honest, genuine, sincere conversation with God that does not have to be complicated. God promises that if you truly search him with your heart and you search him with a sense of humility, he promises to answer you. He promises that you will find him. And so I'm going to share a few more things today, but I'm just going to just lead you in an example of a prayer that you could say if you wanted to sincerely experience Jesus today. And so you might say something like this, Lord, I'm a skeptic. I have my issues. I have my doubts. I'm not too sure what to believe, but I want to pursue the truth and I want to find you. Lord, if you're real, would you speak to me? Would you reveal yourself to me? Would you make yourself known to me? Would you become real to me? And Lord, if you truly are real, just come into my life. Show yourself to me. Because I really want to find you if you're there. You can pray a prayer something like that. You can pray that today. You could have prayed that right now. You can pray this after the service. You can pray it sometime this week. You choose your own words. But if you come to him with a sense of humility and honesty and sincerity, and if you sincerely want to experience him, he will not deny you. He promises that he will become real to you. Let's continue on in verse 50. In 51, Jesus said, you believe because I told you, I saw you under the fig tree. You will see greater things than that. This last verse is jam-packed with some theological significance. I'll just go ahead and read it and explain. He then added, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." There are a lot of things going on in that one verse and that claim that Jesus just made of himself. And the Jewish person who maybe would have been familiar with the Old Testament would have realized what Jesus was saying here. But so let me explain a few things. First of all, Jesus is referencing a dream that Israel's father, one of their patriarchs, had, and his name was Jacob, in other words, Israel. And Jacob had this dream that was given to him by God, this vision of heaven and earth, and there was this ladder between heaven and earth. And it was this vision of angels coming down from heaven to earth upon this ladder. And within this vision, within this dream, God promised to bless Israel. He promised to bless the entire world. And so by Jesus saying here that you will see the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man, he's saying, I am that ladder. I am the connection between heaven and earth. I am the mediator. I am the fulfillment of God's promise to bless Israel and bless the entire world. That is an incredible statement that he's making about himself. There's something else he's saying here. He's referring to himself as the Son of Man. And in the Son of Man, Daniel talks about the Son of Man in the Old Testament. He's an Old Testament prophet. And I'll just read to you what this Son of Man means. Coming from Daniel 7, verse 13 to 14, he says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Side note, that's a song. This passage reminds me of a song that Heather and I love to jam to. It's a song by Ron Canole called Ancient of Days, and whenever our kids kind of blast it, we start bopping and dancing. Does anyone know that song, Ancient of Days, Ron Canole? A few people are nodding your heads. Oh, it's phenomenal. I got sidetracked there, sorry. Anyways, Jesus is saying, I am the Son of Man, this passage speaks about. I have this everlasting dominion, this everlasting authority, and I'm going to be this one that's going to be worshipped through all the nations. Jesus is making some incredible claims about himself, and we've only gotten to the first chapter of John. It is jam-packed with theological significance, which is amazing. Just in this short passage alone, and I've explained a bunch of these terms in previous messages, but Jesus, he's called the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He's called Rabbi and Teacher. He's called Messiah, the one foretold about by Moses and the prophets, the Son of God, the King of Israel, the fulfillment of God's promise to Jacob and Israel, the one whom the world is going to be blessed through, the mediator between heaven and earth, the Son of Man, the one who sits on God's throne, who'll be worshipped for eternity. Jesus is everything. That's what the author of John is trying to say here. And just as he invited and commanded these disciples to follow me, he's speaking to you today and to me today, and he's saying the same thing. He's saying, follow me. And to follow Jesus is to become a disciple. And to become a disciple is to mean to have this close and personal relationship with the Lord. It means a lifetime of service and commitment to him. It's a wholehearted commitment to him. Are you ready for that? And so who do you identify with today? Do you identify with the first group of disciples, the disciples of John, who immediately, at the drop of a hat, they left John, the greatest prophet who ever lived. They followed Jesus. Are you a true and sincere searcher of truth? Or are you like Peter, where you found Jesus when you weren't even really looking for him? And do you recognize that, and are you ready to accept that he has a new identity and a new purpose for you? Are you like the third disciple? Are you like Philip? Have you heard Jesus' command to follow him today? And will you obey? How are you going to respond to that command? Or are you kind of like the pessimistic skeptic, Nathaniel? Will you seek to remain in your skepticism? Or will you reach out in a humble and sincere way and will you reach out to experience him today? You need to know that Jesus is not just a theological concept. He is a real person. He's not just a philosophical concept. He's a real person who wants a real relationship with you. So I think we need to take his challenge seriously to follow him. One last thing I'll say here as well is that there's a number of disciples that did something very consistent once they decided to follow Jesus. Their names are John the Baptist, Andrew, and Philip. As soon as they decided to follow Jesus, they told someone else. It was automatic. It was automatic. When you become a disciple, you become a missionary. And so are you pointing people to Christ? You know, it could be as simple as inviting someone over for dinner, talking to someone on the soccer field, at the grocery store, friends. Are you inviting those around you to come and see Jesus for themselves? And to be honest with you, I don't know if there is such a thing as a Christian who doesn't point people to Jesus. And that's something you can actually discuss in your small groups this coming week. That's one question that Joel put in there. You know, is it really possible to be a Christian and not tell anyone about him? So good luck discussing that, if you even get to that question. But anyways, again, Jesus calls us. He says, follow me. It's the greatest of all the invitations we've ever been given, of all the challenges we've ever been challenged with, of all the commands that we've ever been commanded. The greatest command is when Jesus looks at us and says, follow me. What's your response? What are you doing?